You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Rob Ferret. Coming up later on in the program, we'll learn more about what makes electric fish and eels electric.
If you bought a pack of cigarettes or a case of beer in the last few decades, you've probably noticed a warning on the package, courtesy of the United States Surgeon General. But how much do you really know about the so-called nation's doctor?
Our next guest has written a book that takes a look at the history of the office and its role in American society. And while we'd like to think that the Surgeon General is the leading authority on public health in this country, our guest says that that office doesn't hold as much power as it used to. And in an era of declining budgets and other high-profile health figures, it may no longer make sense for the country to keep the position.
Joining us now is Mike Stobie. He's the national medical correspondent for the Associated Press, and his new book is called Surgeon General's Warning: How Politics Crippled the Nation's Doctor. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
So it seems as though the role of Surgeon General is open to interpretation to a certain extent, maybe more so in the past, but what exactly is the Surgeon General charged with doing?
Well, these days, the Surgeon General is mainly a health educator, a spokesman on public health issues on behalf of the government. There was a time when the Surgeon General was the most powerful person in the federal public health structure. I mean, this is the person who oversaw the CDC, who oversaw the NIH. Those are powers that were taken away decades ago. Now he or she is a spokesman.
You start off your book with Regina Benjamin, a recent Surgeon General, who pretty much embodies the idea that Surgeon Generals have little impact anymore. How did her term play out?
She was interesting. She was this figure who had founded a clinic that served the poor in a small town in Alabama, and she'd gotten some national press for doing these wonderful efforts and keeping her clinic open even after hurricanes and fire destroyed it. But she turned out to be a very quiet presence with very low visibility. I cover public health. I cover the CDC and national public health issues for the AP. By the way, I'm one of several medical correspondents. I'm not the only one. But the people on my beat, I talked to them about my project as I was working on it, this book, and I found many of them couldn't even name her. They didn't know the identity of the current Surgeon General while she was in office, and that was striking to me. She resigned last year. She still had several months left on her term, but she kind of quietly faded away.
You portray her in the book as someone who was just kind of happy to be there, who didn't want to make a lot of waves. She didn't even have the Twitter handle Surgeon General because that was taken. She was forced to take this obscure one instead, sort of indicative of the fact that, you know, there was not a lot of power behind her position at that point, and she was not a person who came wanting to, seemingly, to have a voice.
Yeah, that's right. She didn't have any great ambition. She's a very nice person, by the way, and was gracious enough to let me come visit her, you know, in her first official days in the office. I got to watch her confirmation ceremony. But, yeah, from the beginning, she was candid that she didn't have a burning issue she wanted to work on. And it was clear from tracing the history of other Surgeons General that some of the ones that had the most visibility and perhaps the most impact were people who kind of had a fire in their belly about something. C. Everett Koop on smoking. He was a relentless crusader against smoking, you know, shaking his finger at the tobacco industry. And Joycelyn Elders, many people remember Dr. Elders from the early 1990s, crusading on teenage pregnancy. And Dr. Benjamin just really didn't have anything in particular that she wanted to work on. She said she'd be happy to do anything that the administration assigned her. And my reporting found that they didn't assign her much.
You mentioned some of the past Surgeons General who did have a lot of influence in their role. When they had that high profile, what kind of relationship did Surgeons General have with Americans?
I'm sorry, with Americans?
With Americans, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it helps to be visible and known. I think there's an interest by the public to have, I'm searching for a better term, but a stand-up guy who, you know, is in the federal public health system, somebody who, you know, they can trust. We all know that there's politics going on in Washington, and that there may be times when, even when the science suggests that, for example, needle exchange programs are a good way to combat AIDS and HIV, or the promotion of certain types of sex education is maybe a better strategy than abstinence-only programs. There are politics that for different reasons may cause an administration, an HHS secretary, even a CDC director to kind of shrink away from putting out some of those controversial messages. So I think there's a thirst by at least some Americans for somebody out there who could speak truth to power, to use the jargon, and say what the science is, to be an adjudicator of science, and you know, who will tell the truth beyond political considerations or implications. And the Surgeon General at time has been that quasi-independent force. Coop worked under Reagan, but he said things that were not consistent with the Reagan administration. David Satcher worked under Clinton and George W. Bush. He put out reports that contradicted some of the messaging of the of those administrations. So that's happened in our history, and people, especially older people who remember Satcher, Coop, elders, people 40 and older, I think remember that and look for those days to come again.
And will they? Is it possible that the powers of the Surgeon General will increase once more?
You know, anything's possible. I came to the conclusion, you know, I worked on this book for about 7 years, and for much of that time, I was thinking, you know, this is a job with terrific potential, and we just have to figure out a way to put in safeguards and bring these stand-up guys and stand-up women back into a position where they're not facing political meddling and they can perform the service. But, you know, gradually, I just from watching different people hold the office, I kind of changed my mind and reluctantly and sadly came to the conclusion that it's just not going to happen. Inside the Beltline, most of the power brokers, I came to believe, don't have a real interest in having a quasi-independent Surgeon General. Presidential administrations do not want the headache of somebody who's off message. People in Congress, most notably, but not exclusively, social conservatives are not interested in safeguarding a position who may go off and talk about gun violence and gun control, or may go off and talk about condom distribution. People don't want to spend their political capital on that position. They have their own things to deal with. And as I was suggesting earlier, I guess, if you're younger than 40, maybe you don't even know much about a Surgeon General. You don't remember Coop. And it doesn't mean anything to you. So I don't think it's a fight that's going to happen. I don't think anyone's going to take up arms in favor of the Surgeon General. And so what do we have? We have a situation where this is just going to kind of drag out, and we spend, it's not a lot of money. I mean, the Surgeon General's salary is around $200,000, and the office is small. It's not a ton of money that's spent on this, but you know, we're seeing thousands and thousands and thousands of job reductions in local health departments across the country these last several years. And, you know, $200,000 will get you maybe an epidemiologist or two, or, you know, some other
spending the money,
you know,
somewhere
positions.
Else.
Yeah, you could spend it somewhere else. So do we let this drag out, or, you know, do we move on and just say, sadly, that time is over?
Well, let's look at the roots of this position. How did the role of Surgeon General first come into being? What was the purpose of it?
Well, it was the first Surgeon General went into office in 1871, and it was a different job then. There was this thing called the Marine Hospital Service that was created way at the beginning of the country, and it was actually a network of federal hospitals for sailors. It had its origins back in England, you know, after the English Navy defeated the Spanish Armada, and a grateful England said, we need to do something for the sailors. We need to have some way of providing care for them, you know, because they saved our nation. And that tradition was carried on to the colonies. And so we had federal marine hospitals, a little string of hospitals spread throughout the country, which took care of sailors. But it gradually became a mess. I mean, the hospitals were largely under local control, and there was cronyism, and the hospitals fell into disrepair. And there were several federal reviews of this through the years, and each time said, you know, we need to clean up the system. Finally, there was a set of reforms passed, and they said, we're going to create a new head position for this. We're going to call them the supervising surgeon of the Marine Hospital System. Well, the supervising surgeon this was a period where the nation was dealing with a lot of epidemics, cholera, yellow fever, and the emerging public health system in our nation was kind of struggling in the best way to control epidemics and who would lead it, and, you know, are states the best ones to institute quarantines, and all this stuff was going on. And the early surgeons general, the early supervising surgeons of the Marine Hospital Service laid claim to that function, quarantine control and disease control, because their hospitals were in the ports. A lot of these diseases came in through ports. And, you know, there were some political fights back then, but they ended up winning, and they became the head of the federal system. They were in charge of quarantines, and they became very powerful. And as new agencies came on board, as the CDC was created, as the NIH was created, these things fell under the position that later became known as the Surgeon General in charge of the U.S. Public Health Service.
So pretty different beginning there. We're talking now with Mike Stobie about the history and role of the Surgeon General in the United States, and you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what the Surgeon General does or maybe should be doing? Do you remember the work of C. Everett Koop or Luther Terry on subjects like AIDS or smoking? Did it have an impact on you? And do you think it still makes sense to have a Surgeon General in the United States? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up that conversation in just a moment, but right now here's a few headlines we're keeping an eye on this afternoon with Kristen Durst of the WPR News Department. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking to Mike Stobie, author of Surgeon General's Warning about the History and Role of the Office in the United States.
And you can join in the discussion, too, at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the Surgeon General, the Office of Surgeon General, and what that office, what that person should be doing? Do you have memories of Surgeon General's past that really stuck with you, that really accomplished something? And do you think it still makes sense to have that office? 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, talk@WPR.org.
And we were talking earlier about C. Everett Koop, one of the more memorable Surgeons General of recent years. He's one that I remember as well, Mike. He was someone who stuck in your mind as you were writing this book. Let's take a listen to the kind of personality that he brought to the role. Here he is talking about his role becoming a spokesperson for education on AIDS.
that became associated with drug abuse, with sexual promiscuity, and with IV drug paraphernalia. And a huge number of the conservatives in this country said they deserve what they got. Just ignore them and let them die. Well, you can't be a doctor and do that. Mm-hmm. You can't be the Surgeon General and do that. Mm-hmm. I'm the Surgeon General of the moral and the immoral, the males and the females, and you treat them as you would any patient that comes to you for help.
A bit there from C. Everett Koop, one of the more recent Surgeons General of Influence. We go down to the phone lines. Connor joins us in Cumberland. Hi, Connor.
Hi.
What did you want to say?
It seems to me that the Surgeon General's office does more than, the Surgeon General himself. So wouldn't it make more sense to kind of just eliminate the big, head of the office and kind of minimize it and make, have them kind of do some of the regulatory stuff, but just downsize the Surgeon General's office?
Okay, interesting point. What do you say to that, Mike?
Well, I mean, the Surgeon General's office is already a bare-bones operation. I think the staff is 10 people currently or less. They just support, and they're not all of them are assigned to the Surgeon General full-time. But Regina Benjamin didn't even have her own speechwriter. That's what she told me. And I think that ship has sailed in terms of, the Surgeon General having more administrative powers. Those are stripped away during the Johnson administration in 1968. The Johnson administration became very dissatisfied with the Surgeon General, especially his troops, the commission corps officers in the public health, and didn't feel they were really moving the ball on the things that they wanted to get done in terms of great society programs. So, the Surgeon General no longer was overseeing the CDC, no longer overseeing NIH, no longer doing that stuff. So I hope I'm not misunderstanding your point, but I think that's not on the table anymore. I don't think the HHS secretary or the CDC director or the FDA commissioner are going to be ceding any powers to the Surgeon General.
Right. They're not going to want to add duties, responsibilities, oversight to the role of Surgeon General because there's already this tension of power between those agencies and the Surgeon General.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Connor. We're going to go next to Scott joining us from Toma. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I vaguely remember a conversation at the beginning of the Obama administration when he was forming his cabinet, et cetera, that CNN's Sanjay Gupta was being considered for that role. And frankly, I don't remember if he withdrew his name from consideration or that never got very far. But it seemed at the time like, he's one of the better, more widely known medical professionals in the country. Can you tell me a little more about what happened at that time?
Great. Thanks, Scott.
Yeah, good question. Your memory is right. Gupta was reportedly the main choice. He acknowledged it, that he had been approached and sat down with the Obama people and was thinking hard about it. He went up to visit Coop and talk about it. And people were excited because, the Surgeon General's job had been sort of lapsing into kind of irrelevant status. And here was this guy. He was a superstar. He's on TV. He's this respected authority. A reporter, and a neurosurgeon. And he was somebody that they thought people would listen to, and might give the job visibility it hadn't seen in at least a decade. But he, things got messy. I mean. The Surgeon General is one of a whole set of officials, and there was, I don't know if you remember, Tom Daschle was going to be, for the senator from South Dakota, was the initial choice for HHS secretary, and the plan was that everyone was going to work on health reform, And, you know, Daschle would lead it, but Gupta would work with Daschle, and Gupta would not only be a Surgeon General, but he'd be a main salesman, a main spokesman on behalf of the administration for the need for health reform, for what became the Affordable Care Act. But then Daschle had to pull out. There was some controversy over, I'm trying to remember what it was, back taxes or something. There was a controversy that raged for, you know, weeks, and it was a headache, and Daschle withdrew. So some of the cast that Gupta was going to work with was changing. And you know, Gupta's a fairly young guy, and he draws income from his medical work and from CNN, and he's got a young family. And given everything else that was going on and the change of people he'd be working with, he pulled out. One thing that has affected the Surgeon General job, this is not a high-paying job. I mean, I said it's close to $200,000, but as you recognize, there's people in the medical field who make a lot more than that. And in the past, there have been people who haven't taken the job largely because it didn't pay enough. I don't know that was a main motivation for Gupta, but it was certainly something he considered.
And Mike, in our last minute here, what do you think the American public misses out on, if anything, by not having a strong Surgeon General anymore?
Well, I think sometimes we're adrift as you know, controversies come along. You know, as people start appearing on TV and saying, well, I think vaccines cause autism. And when there's no one, this happened several years ago, and Jenny McCarthy was on Oprah Winfrey, and you know, Oprah has a huge audience, and she was talking about her experience with her child, and no one went on the show to oppose her. There was no, you know, and some argue that's a game you can't win. You can't go on Oprah with Jenny McCarthy and convince the audience that you're right and they're wrong, but nobody tried. And when we don't have a Surgeon General, someone in the uniform who's instantly esteemed, countering these messages, you know, we've seen the results of that. We've seen vaccination exemptions go up in some states, and we've seen the resurgence of measles and some other vaccine preventable diseases. We're constantly facing e-cigarettes,
and we're going to have to leave it there. Mike, thank you so much. We're out of time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Sorry, I went over.
We've been talking to Mike Stovey, national medical correspondent for the Associated Press. His new book is called Surgeon General's Warning.